Now, as we've mentioned in previous weeks, during our progress through these particular chapters in Exodus, as you know, we're working from verses chapters 11 through to 20 in this particular section, and we've already mentioned how the bringing of the children of Israel out of Egypt was the defining event for them as a nation, in forging them as a nation, as opposed to merely a people group of extended families, which is basically what they were when they first came down into Egypt, and they simply increased in number and expanded and so on, but they hadn't gelled and formulated as a nation. They were the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but they were not a nation, a people as such, owned by the Lord in that sense, and with that unique relationship with him. They ought to have been, but they weren't at that stage. And despite the fearfulness of the 10 plagues of Egypt, it is this event in chapter 14, the crossing of the Red Sea, which is the ultimate event in the entire story of the Israelite nation, even to this day. Now, we have, each of us, a birth certificate. We could find it if we rummaged about in our files or drawers or whatever. And that birth certificate, of course, has various details about our parentage and our date and time and location of birth. But the two most important things, perhaps, one which defines us so much for officialdom, and the other that maybe helps to define our identity, are the when and the where of our birth. Nowadays, you'll find increasingly that when you're entering in any sort of officialdom or database, they don't ask you for your name or your address, they'll ask you for your date of birth. And you give your date of birth and they type it in and then they come up with your details. So the date of birth, the hour, the day when you enter into this world, not that that's when you first become alive. You are alive for all the 9 months in your mother's womb, but these months are kind of undefined because we can't say the precise moment at which conception takes place. We can't identify exactly the growth and development of the child within the womb. The first identifiable hour or moment of our lives, the birth that can be recorded in that sense, is the moment of our birth. And so our date of birth becomes part of that which defines us. And also for ourselves, we could say the where. The location where we are born becomes crucial as part of defining who we are. Whether we're born in this country or this place or that place, it becomes part of our identity, almost our nationality, perhaps, is partly defined by that. So the when and the where are vital aspects of our birth certificate and our identity. But as we are defined by that earliest of identifiable events in our lives, so likewise it is with the Israelite nation here. We find this nation forever afterwards identified by their relationship to God who brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. That's the defining thing. He brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. And for all the ferocity and fearfulness of the 10 plagues, which were fearful, and we looked at each of them as we looked through those particular chapters, it is this event of crossing the Red Sea, which is the defining event, the ultimate event in Israel's history, the demonstration of God's divine deliverance of his people. This nation is forever afterwards identified by their relationship to this God who brought them out of Egypt. The ultimate event of the divine expression of that birth of a nation. It's this parting of the Red Sea. If it's not indelicate to use the simile of breaking of the waters, we might say, and the bringing forth of not only one person, but a whole people, a whole nation onto the other side, onto the Sinai Peninsula side. We have by then a nation forged by this effectual experience, passing through the waters of the Red Sea and coming out the other side, which they can't do themselves. It is something which God does. He brings them to birth as a nation. The forging, the bringing forth of a new nation, who, you know, like it or not, are never going back again into Egypt. They're never going back to what they were before. And again, they would never be the same again. So this coming forth out of Egypt continues to be referenced throughout Scripture. It's not just, you know, during the time when they're in the wilderness, which might be understandable. It's not just in the days of Joshua when they come into the promised land. It's referenced again in the books of Judges. It's referenced again in Samuel and in the Kings and in all the prophets, right up to Zechariah, the end, towards the end of the Old Testament. It's referenced again in the New Testament, in the Acts of the Apostles, when Stephen is giving his testimony before his death, when Paul is giving the account of for himself before the Jewish leaders and before the Romans, and when he defines the Israelite nation by their being brought out of Egypt. It's referenced again in the letter to the Hebrews. It's referenced again in Jude, the second last book of the Bible. God is still making reference to this through his inspired writers all the way through Scripture. It is something so cataclysmic, we might say, in terms of how God brings this people out of nothing. It is something that he does which is deliberate, and which is so incredible that, you know, you couldn't make it up. You know, scholars and skeptics say, oh, you know, they probably just paddled across a narrow bit of marshy ground, and then the tide came in, and that's what maybe swamped the Egyptians a wee bit. Now, this, you know, business of a wall of water on either side, of course, that never happened. And they may dispute the details of what they think or believe may have happened, but nobody disputes the fact of this event, because you couldn't make it up. Nobody would dare to make it up. It is so incredible. It is so amazing that only God could do something like that. Nobody would dare to make it up. It would literally, after it had happened, never be forgotten, but continue to be talked about and remembered forever. And to this day, when Jewish people have their Passover meals and so on, which they do every year, what is it they're remembering? Deliverance from the land of Egypt. That defining event of which, yes, the night of the Passover is itself special, but that in itself is succeeded by this crossing of the Red Sea. This is the ultimate expression of divine deliverance. So we have the people of Israel. If we can backtrack slightly from chapter 14 into the end of chapter 13, where we see they took their journey from Succoth and encamped in Etham in the edge of the wilderness. Now, the edge of the wilderness could mean a variety of things. It could simply mean, you know, if you were to look at, say, a satellite picture of the delta region in Egypt, you'd probably see that it's green in the delta areas, and particularly in the ancient world it would have been green where it was irrigated, where the delta river areas were making the land able to be productive, but where that water gives out, where the irrigation doesn't continue, it becomes dry desert. So it could mean the edge of the delta area, you know, as close in as that to Egypt, or it could mean basically the head of the Gulf of Suez, basically near where the town of Suez is nowadays, and it could mean that at the top of the Red Sea there, the edge of the wilderness. So we can't exactly define what is meant by the edge of the wilderness. Scholars appear to be agreed as to where Succoth was in verse 20 of chapter 13 there, and it would be approximately 50 miles from Succoth to what is the most likely, perhaps, crossing point of the Israelites to the Red Sea. Now, that's, you could see, how long would it take them to travel 50 miles? It depends how fast they're moving. They can only move as fast as the slowest moving individual. Remember that this is a huge body of people that is moving. My father, when we were children, used to get exasperated when we were going off on a holiday or something like that, as the car was being packed up and the suitcases were going one by one from the house up to where the car was parked, and he used to get, then one thing would be remembered and another thing would be forgotten, and he was just about at his wit's end by the time we finally drove off and set off. And he always used to say that the amount of time it takes that actually get off on a journey, it multiplies exponentially according to the number of people involved in the journey. So if it's just you, then you've got a chance of packing your bag, getting in the car and going away. If there's two of you, well, it takes a wee bit longer because the two people with kids. If there's three of you, if there's a whole family of you, you haven't a chance of getting away that morning or whenever it happened to be, because there's always more things to forget and remember and people to be considered and bring. Now, here we've got, as chapter 12 tells us at verse 37, 600,000 on foot that were men beside children. Now, we don't know whether that men means explicitly male adults, or whether it means men in the sense of grown-up adults, men and women together, because it just says besides children, it doesn't say besides women and children. But even if it means men and women together, 600,000, there's likely to be pretty much one child at least per couple. So half as many again, so another 300,000, let's say. These are conservative estimates. You know, you've got nearly a million people, and then you've got the mixed multitude, verse 38 of chapter 12, adding into that, we don't know how many there were then, so you've got over a million people who are moving slowly, and then camping, and then moving on again, and then camping. How long does it take them to get to the head of the Gulf of Suez? Well, we don't know exactly, of course. The thing is that we're not actually told. It is most likely, and we can only to an extent speculate, but it's most likely that it's probably the 3-day mark to get roughly to the top of the Gulf of Suez from when they begin to set off when they first leave Faro. But we don't know. And we might say, well, wait a minute, isn't that where they were meant to be having their feast at the 3-day journey? Surely they were meant to have got to Mount Sinai by now. You know, 3 days into the wilderness so they can have a feast to the Lord. That's meant to be it, isn't it? Well, this is what people sometimes say, and skeptics and critics will say, oh, come on, 3 days into the wilderness, how could they possibly reach Mount Sinai in 3 days? The Bible does not actually say that Mount Sinai was where they were to have the feast to the Lord. There's what we think the Bible says, and there's then what it actually says. It's like, you know, people will confidently assert that Jesus was born in a stable. It doesn't say Jesus was born in a stable. It says he was laid in a manger, because there was no room for him to be in. It doesn't mention a stable at all. They will confidently assert there were three wise men. It doesn't say there were three wise men. We are told that there were wise men who came from the east and that they gave three particular kinds of gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. It doesn't say that there were crowds and crowds of people gathered in the Sermon on the Mount. It simply says that Jesus went up the mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, could be as few as 12 people. What the Bible actually says and what we mentally think it says, or are sure that it must surely have said, are not always the same thing. Let's go back to what God said to Moses, chapter 3, at verse 12, where he appears to him in the burning bush, and he said, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. Okay, you'll come here to Mount Sinai, and you'll serve God upon this mountain. It doesn't say how long it's going to take you to get there. So, but by verse 18, Moses is being told to say, the Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. These two things are not necessarily the same thing. We mentally think, oh yeah, that's what he's talking about. 3 days into the wilderness must mean Mount Sinai. Doesn't say that. 3 days into the wilderness, and then have the sacrifice and the feast to the Lord, that we may serve the Lord there. That's the modest request Moses is told to make of Pharaoh. If he is told to say, let's go all the way to Mount Sinai, then Pharaoh would say no. Even when he says 3 days into the wilderness, Pharaoh still says no. But the point is, it's such a modest little request that Pharaoh saying no demonstrates that he has no excuse, no reason for saying so. We go on into chapter 5, and we see at verse 3 again, the God of the Hebrews hath met with us, let us Let us go, we pray thee, 3 days' journey into the desert, and sacrifice unto the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or the sword. And again in chapter 8, verse 27 and 28, we read, we will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, and sacrifice to the Lord our God, as he shall command us. And Pharaoh said, I will let you go, that ye may sacrifice to the Lord your God. Only ye shall not go very far away, entreat for me. In the meantime, God keeps on saying to them, to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh, let my people go, that they may serve me. Chapter 7, at verse 16, likewise, we read, thou shalt say unto them, the Lord God of the Hebrews hath sent me unto thee, say, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. Again, chapter 8, verse 1, chapter 8, verse 20, chapter 9, verse 1, chapter 9, verse 13, chapter 10, verse 3, and so it goes on. Let my people go, that they may serve me. But he doesn't specify exactly where at that point. If Sinai was meant to be the 3 days' journey in the wilderness, then the children of Israel would need to have covered something like 170 to 200 miles in 3 days. That's just not doable. It's just not happening. Even if you're not trying to cross the Red Sea, it's not happening with 1.2 million people or whatever as quick as that. So what do we find if we go then into chapter 19, when the people actually arrive at Mount Sinai? What we find there is, in the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai, for they were departed from Rephidim, and were come to the desert of Sinai, had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel encamped before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, and so on. 3 months. In the third month. No way is Mount Sinai meant to be the 3 day journey, when it takes 3 months for the children of Israel to get there. God would have known that. But there's what we mentally think the Bible is saying, and what it is actually saying. God is not saying the 3 days' journey is Mount Sinai. But we may tend to join up the dots in the wrong direction, as do, of course, the critics and cynics in the Bible. It takes 3 months to travel that 120 miles, roughly, from the most likely crossing point of the Red Sea, plus the extra 50 miles from Succoth, and so on. It's a huge amount of terrain to cover in extremely hostile territory with over 1 million people. How are you going to do that? You know, it was never intended to be so. But the Lord intends to bring his people out of Egypt and to bring them safe to where he wants them to be. The Bible does not say how long after the Israelites left Pharaoh that Pharaoh decided to chase after them. We kind of mentally think it was the next day, but it doesn't say that. It could have been 3 days, it could have been 3 weeks. The most likely period is that they traveled their 3 days' journey, which would have brought them roughly to the head of the Gulf of Suez. And there they have the choice of either to have their sacrifice, their feast to the Lord, and potentially then say, right, we've had our feast now, we're going back into Egypt, back into bondage. Theoretically, they could have done that, and that would have been the letter of their covenant fulfilled. And Pharaoh will have had people watching them from a distance. He'll have had scouts and spies going out, watching from hilltops to see where they went and how they travelled. And what he will observe is that when they have come to camp after approximately 3 days, then what do they do? Well, this is what we see in verse 2 here, chapter 14. Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pihahiroth. Now, that implies a change of direction, so that instead of carrying on round the top of the Gulf of Suez and on into the Sinai Peninsula, which they could have done, and begin to put some distance between themselves and the Egyptians, they are told instead to turn down the Egyptian side of the Red Sea, or the Gulf of Suez, and continue down into the desert that way. And they think, well, why on earth would they do that? That's just taking them back into enemy territory. That doesn't make any sense. But this is quite clear. Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn. and encamp. Don't carry on in the same direction you're going. Turn in the sense of turn back, make a change of direction. And so they turn from the head of the Gulf of Suez down the Egyptian side of the Gulf there, and however many miles they travel down, maybe it's half a dozen miles, the most likely crossing point. Some scholars think it's a further 20-odd miles down to the place, modern-day Attica, that they could have crossed there. It's about 20 miles across the sea there. It's near 5 or 6 miles at the most likely crossing point, a bit nearer to modern-day Suez. But at any rate, they are making a change of direction. They're going down the left-hand side, the western side now of the Gulf of Suez there. And this word turn is highly significant, that they turn and encamp before Beharihof. Now, Beharihof means the mouth of the gully. So which it implies one of these dry gullies coming down from a sort of mountainous region, which then comes down to the Red Sea itself, through which, in times of winter or water time, the waters will gush down this gully and flow into the sea. But most of the time, it will be dry. Now, you've got a major such gully at Attica, about 20 miles down, which would be the wider crossing point. But again, 20 miles with 1.2 million people takes quite a while to cover. It's more likely, though we're speculating, that we're looking at a smaller gully, Beharihof, at the mouth of which they camp. Baal Zephon is almost certainly on the other shore of the Red Sea, but something clearly identifiable that they could see across. It's on the other side, over against Baal Zephon, on the other side of the Red Sea. Before it, shall ye encamp by the sea. We don't know exactly where these places are. We don't know exactly on a map. Some people have speculated that Migdol, which was a fortress, or implies a fortress, is a Machpelah now in modern-day Arabic, but again, difficult to find on maps and so on. But the likelihood is that if Migdol is a fortress, the most likely place to have a fortress is the head of the Gulf of Suez, the location roughly of the town of Suez nowadays. So if you're going between Migdol and the sea, then you're coming to the west, to the south of that. So that it's on the one side of you, blocking your way into Sinai, and the sea is in front of you, and your camp on the coast there. Wherever Beharihof happens to be, the mouth of the gully, they are now to the south and west of the top of Suez, and there is the sea in front of them, and the Egyptians can come in now behind them and catch them. There's nowhere to go but further south into the desert. They are, in other words, as the Lord said, that Pharaoh will say that they are entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. In other words, now we've got them. And so it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled. Now, Pharaoh already knows that they've gone. He told them to go. So this is one reason why it's unlikely that verse 5 means, oh, the Israelites have left. Have they left? Nobody knew they'd left. Only a couple of chapters ago, we were talking about how the Egyptians were pressing them to go. They were urgent upon them. They borrowed goods and riches and gold and silver from their Egyptian neighbors. Pharaoh virtually chased them out of the land. So it doesn't really make sense if now, well, they've told Pharaoh to fled. Have they really gone? My goodness, we didn't realize that. Of course they've gone. You chased them out. So the likely reference to it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled is that verse 5 probably references the fact, okay, they've gone their 3 days' journey. They've reached the head of the Gulf of Suez. That's their 3 days' journey. That's where they should have had their feast. That's where they should have had all their sacrifices. And if they were keeping to what they said, they'd be coming back after that. Because it's after this that he says, no, why have we done this? That we have let Israel go from serving us. We don't know for sure that it's only 3 days later, but it's most likely to be, because otherwise none of these pieces of the jigsaw fit together. He made ready his chariot and took his people with him. He took 600 chosen chariots, or the word that we've got translated as chosen means third men chariots. It's likely that the 600 chosen chariots are virtually Pharaoh's guard, his own personal guard, with a third man in the chariot. Usually a chariot would have one person driving the chariot and one person to fight, to throw the spears or shoot the arrows or whatever. But if you've got a third man in it, it's a big deluxe kind of chariot here. And all the chariots of Egypt, and captains over every one of them. So there's a distinction between the chosen chariots, probably Pharaoh's personal guard, and all the chariots of Egypt, and captains over every one of them. But even with, 600 chariots, and even if there's maybe 1,000 chariots of Egypt as well, that's still only 1,600 chariots, a couple of thousand, 3,000 men, and the Israelites are like 1.2 million people. So they completely outnumber the Egyptians. So why are they so scared of them? Well, you've got to remember that apparently in a civilized society like Egypt, other than for military service, nobody was allowed to bear arms. Nobody was allowed to have any weapons at all. And the Israelites, remember, have been effectively enslaved for 300 to 400 years. All the time they were in Egypt, they wouldn't have been enslaved, not to begin with, but for 200 to 300 years, they have been subservient slaves. So they are terrified of the military might of Egypt now coming against them. With all their weapons and their horses and their chariots, of course they're afraid. It's natural enough that they should be afraid. The Egyptians pursued after them, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. And he overtook them camping by the sea, by Pahanihof, before Baal-zephon. And here they are, caught between the sea on their side, or to go further south into the desert, and the Egyptians coming behind them. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. Well, it's good that they cried out unto the Lord. But what we actually have a record of them saying is, because there were no graves in Egypt, it's like taking us away to die in the wilderness. And it's more of a complaint. Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt? Say, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. You see how self-absorbed and self-centered this is. None of it is looking to the Lord for deliverance. None of it is grateful that they've got this far at all. It's just, why on earth have we let you talk us into this? Why are we here, stuck in the wilderness, and the Egyptians coming down to kill us now? Now, Moses here, we probably underestimate verses 13 and 14. Just how much faith this takes on Moses' behalf. Yes, he has witnessed all the plagues of Egypt. Yes, he has seen the power of the Lord. But anyone who loves the Lord and follows him and serves him knows that just because God has done things a certain way and always fulfilled on particular things he said, doesn't mean that his mind is going to be that way next time. You can't take God's decisions for granted. And so where Hebrews 11 in the New Testament talks about Moses who by faith did this or that or the next thing, we cannot overestimate how much faith Moses must have needed here in verses 13 and 14. Fear ye not, stand still, see the salvation of the Lord. Now the Israelites thought like, how could you have done this to us? Isn't this what we said? But he says, the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. Now, at this stage, I think we could safely say, without any irreverence, Moses does not know what the Lord intends to do. He's not saying, it's okay guys, we're about to walk through the sea. God is going to open up the sea for us, and we're just going to toddle through, no problems, and then it'll close over us again. He doesn't know what God is going to do. He doesn't know how God is going to deliver them. He only knows, trusts, and believes that he will. That God, who has begun the good work, will complete it. That God, who has brought them thus far, will not now leave them to be destroyed in the wilderness. Because apart from anything else, the glory of his name is at stake. It is not because the Israelites are a worthy people. It is not because they're oozing faith and virtue and devotion. Look at how they're already complaining. If this is only 3 days out of their slavehood, here they are already having a moan. And we know how much they moaned when they were in the wilderness. But here they are, before they've even crossed the Red Sea, having a moan. So it's not because they are a virtuous people. It is rather for the glory of His name that the Lord is going to do what He does. And Moses believes that whatever God is going to do, it will be for the deliverance of His people and it will be for the glory of His name. Moses trusts God. The Lord shall fight for you and you shall hold your peace. Now, it may often be the case that we are facing situations in life where we do not know how the Lord is going to outwork His purposes. We do not know how He intends to bring about His work of deliverance. We don't know how He's going to get us through or what His will is going to be. But the good news is we don't have to know these things. You don't have to know the future. You only have to trust the Lord to take you into it and to know that He has a plan, that He has a purpose, and that He knows exactly what He's doing. God does not make mistakes. And because of this, we, if we are His children, can have faith that He knows what He's doing and that He will deliver us. However what way He chooses to do it, He is able to deliver for the glory of His name. And the Lord said to Moses, "Wherefore criest thou unto me? Lift up thy rod, stretch out thine hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea," and so on. And so the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before their face and stood behind them, came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. It was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all the night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind. Now it's possible that that word that we have translated as east can mean a previous wind, something the Lord had already begun to do, perhaps. But at any rate, it is coming from the east, coming from the direction of the Sinai Peninsula. And clearly it must be wind that is funneled in such a way by God's work of divine overruling, funneled in such a way as to drive down into the sea and to force the waters apart. Now the problem then with that is, okay, let's say God forces the waters apart, makes them pile up like that, that's great. How are the Israelites going to come across the sea if they're coming across in the teeth of such a gale as that? So we would have to likewise assume that God, in forcing that wind, forcing apart the waves and piling them up on either side, likewise caused the wind to be so nuanced and so particular that the wind itself divides and the Israelites are able to come through in the midst of it. It must be that way. Because if the wind itself is what the Lord is using to part the waves, and it must be some strength of wind, and it must be happening all night, but that's what we read. It's caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night. It took a night's worth of that strength of wind to part the sea, to build up the waters on either side. The way that we read the remainder of the chapter, you could take it to mean, and that night when the waters parted, they all went across. We're not talking about 30 people here. We're not talking about 300 or 3,000. We're talking about over 1 million souls. Now, let's say for the sake of argument that the crossing point is the narrower of the two options, about 5 or 6 miles across. Now, if you want something to think about, if you're in the Point Peninsula, I have to go up and down to Garabos regularly, as you know. If you're in Garabos, or if you're somewhere in Point and you're looking across Broad Bay to call or to back or whatever, we're talking about roughly the distance from Upper Point across to call or to back. If the sea across Broad Bay were parted, then you've got the time it takes for a million plus people to go from one location to the other across that length of distance of water. If we're talking about the wider option further down the Gulf of Suez with about 20 miles worth of water, then you're probably looking at the distance roughly between Elon Glass, the lighthouse, and Duntulum over on Trotternichan Sky. It's a little bit further than that, but roughly that sort of distance. So if the Little Minch was completely parted and we were all toddling across from Elon Glass across to Duntulum, that's quite a distance. And for 1.2 million people or whatever, it's not just going to take a few hours in the night. The more likely option is that whether we're talking about Broad Bay kind of distance, or whether we're talking about the Little Minch, and the difference between 5 or 6 miles on the one hand, or about 20 miles on the other hand, but this number of people we're probably looking at, it took a night for the waters to be parted, and it was a day and a night for the people to cross to the other side. And that when the people were most of the way across, the Lord lifted the cloud that enabled the Egyptians to follow in. Now, this is the thing we have to grasp here. This isn't an accident. God intends this to happen. He intends not only that his people should be free of the pursuit of the Egyptians once they're down into the Sinai Peninsula, which was still Egyptian territory, really, but also that having destroyed the military force that came against them, it would be such an event that, as we have said, it would be talked about forever afterwards. The Egyptians would know that the Lord was God in the midst of the world. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So the Lord glorified himself against the Egyptians on the one hand, who would never forget it, but also he delivered his own people in such a way that however frightening the 10 plagues might have been, this was absolutely terrifying. Now, we haven't begun to talk yet about the fact of going through the sea, but just the fact of getting through it, and then it closing over your enemies again, and you see them washed up dead with the tide on the seashore. The dread and the terror of the proverbial near miss would have struck fear into their hearts, as it did, and as it was designed to do. God intended to destroy the Egyptian army in the sea. He could have taken his children of Israel round the top of the Gulf of Suez and down in the Sinai Peninsula that way. There's always the threat of pursuit. There's always the anxiety. What if the Egyptians come after them? What if they don't believe that they're really free? God intended to do such a work as would be remembered forever afterwards and would demonstrate his power over all the might and military of this world. So he intends to do that. Now let's think for a moment or two about the parting of the sea here. The wind coming in such a way, the Israelites in their camp cannot help but feel that wind all night. It's such a gale as comes through, but it is such a deliberately positioned and sort of a pointed kind of wind, in such a targeted wind, that it comes to a very narrow point. Now, when a wind is coming through a narrow space or through a narrow point, it is, of course, intensified. So the power to drive apart the waters and to go right down to the seabed and force the waters up on either side and then separate out the water, we're talking about a huge amount of strength of wind here. But let's never underestimate the strength that wind has. We're experiencing some of that, a little of it just now, with all the storms we get every other day. But other people down south and in other parts of the world are getting it much worse. You see cars picked up and tossed around like pieces of confetti. You see roofs coming off houses. You see trees uprooted and so on. And all these pictures that you can see on the TV or on the internet. The power of wind, the power of that which is basically air, cannot be underestimated. If it is focused, if it is channeled, if it is targeted in this way, the sea is parted. And the Israelites go into it. And they would have begun to go into it probably in the dawn, just when it's still a bit dark. God's pillar of cloud is, yeah, it's light. Who would have to go in first? Well, it would have to be Moses and Aaron going in first. They would have to say, it's okay, look, it's quite safe, we're going in, here we are. And everybody thinking, no way, gents, you can go in there, but we're not falling. But what's the alternative? There's the Egyptians waiting behind the pillar of cloud, just desperate to avenge all their firstborn, wanting to pour out their wrath on somebody, and they can't get at God, so they're going to get at his people. And they are just champing at the bit to wipe out their former slaves. So, what are you going to do? Head further into the desert, or follow Moses and Aaron into the seabed with a wall of water on either side? Now remember, it's still dark. It's getting lighter, but it's still dark. Now, the pillar of cloud is light to them to an extent. You've got this huge wall of water on one side. You've got a huge wall of water on the other side. Now, the sea is noisy, as you know. So you've got this noisy wall of water on this side and on that side. What are you going to just put your head down and keep going? You follow after Moses and Aaron. You hope to goodness. You pray to the Lord that it's not going to start caving in. Because if you were to touch it, you almost feel that if you touch it, you'll puncture it and it'll come through. So you just don't look. You just keep going through. Now the seabed is not going to be smooth sand. It's not going to be like the nice smooth sand of a seashore. It's going to be full of rocks and uneven surfaces. And I would suggest to you, not only would it be extremely difficult to pick your way across it, you'd have to be very careful where you put your feet. If you've got any wagons, if you've got anything that has to be carried, if you've got little children to carry, it's a major task. You've got to choose your feet. The rocks will probably be slippery, wet, seaweed, all the rest of it. You've got to pick your way. You've got this terrifying wall of water on either side. You've got people all around you. It may be dark. Even if it's daylight, it's going to be pretty much darkened by this huge wall of water on either side. It would be a terrifying experience. And the only thing that would be more terrifying is being caught by the Egyptians. You are, in a sense, literally caught between the followers of the devil and the deep blue sea. Which way do you go? Or the Red Sea, as we might say. So, of course, they're going to follow Moses and Aaron. But in doing so, they would be absolutely terrified. Picking their way over these slippery stones, carrying their children, helping their aged parents. If they've got wagons, they'd be having to manhandle them over the stones. This is why I don't think it's all that surprising that we read that when the Egyptians come after them, they took off their chariot wheels and they drave them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians. It's one thing to drive a chariot over the sand of the desert or hard ground. It's another to drive it through a rocky seabed and over the ground that would be at the base of the sea. Of course a chariot is not designed for it. Of course the Egyptians are going to struggle. It would take an awful lot of courage for the Egyptians too to follow after where the Israelites have gone. They're obeying orders. They're following in after. But they too would have been terrified. Especially when their chariots begin to start coming apart in the midst of the sea. And then when the Israelites are all at the other side, and the last one comes up out of the sea on the Sinai side of the peninsula, the Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand over the sea, that the waters may come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and on their horses. And Moses stretched forth his hand. Now, of course, God could send the waters back down in the Egyptians any time he wanted. He doesn't need Moses to stretch out his hand. Why does he do this? He does this so that Moses is seen to be the one who stretches out his hand. So that God acts when Moses lifts up his hand with the rod, and all the people see that God acts when Moses lifts up his hand. God intends not only to destroy the Egyptians, he intends to lift up Moses in the sight of the people. God doesn't need Moses in order to part the sea or in order to bring it back upon the Egyptians. But he chooses to time his actions in line with what he has specifically told Moses to do, so that the people will see. Moses stretched out his hand and the waters parted. Moses stretched out his hand and the sea came on again. Now Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord, about time, and believed the Lord again, about time, and his servant Moses. This is, if you like, for now, for as far as the coming out of Egypt is concerned, the final piece of that part of the jigsaw. And as we see in subsequent chapters, the fear and the faith doesn't last all that long, but at least it is there for now. Now, of course, there are those who will say, and have said, of course, in the past, that, but it wasn't really a deep sea. It was just, you know, the Hebrew term is Yam Suf, which means sea of reeds. It just means a reedy, marshy sea. They were just paddling across this, and the Egyptians just came after them, and they just sunk in the mire a wee bit. Well, exactly the same Hebrew term, Yam Suf, which means reedy sea, or sea of reeds. And they, oh, that's what it means, reed sea, not red sea. But here we have, in 1 Kings chapter 9, at verse 26, King Solomon made a navy of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth, on the shore of the Red Sea. In Hebrew, Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds. Exactly the same terms. Now, you may paddle people across a sea of reeds and say, look, that's what they're doing. They're not walking on dry land. They're just walking through a marsh. But you can't exactly launch a navy of ships on such a muddy marsh as that. And that's exactly what Solomon is doing. Red Sea, Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds, exactly the same description, except it's in the other gulf, the Gulf of Aqaba, instead of the Gulf of Suez. Same word. You've got to explain away somehow how the Lord delivers his people out of the hands of the Egyptians, how he gets them across the Red Sea. This deliverance would have been, as we said, absolutely terrifying. Sometimes the Lord requires us to go through that which is frightening, that which is terrifying. But in order to glorify his name, he does not leave his children there in the midst of it. He brings them through. He brings them out the other side, and he glorifies his name by them being compelled to say, this is the Lord's doing. And it is marvelous in our eyes. Now that is what he has done with every soul that he saves and delivers through Jesus Christ. That is what he has done with his people of Israel here. That is what he intends and longs and invites to happen for every single sinner that he calls to come to himself. Wait and see what the Lord will do in your life if you would come to him and accept of his deliverance. And yes, it will be frightening. And yes, it will be unlike anything you've been through before. And yes, you may hesitate and you may fear, and it may only be the greater fear of what will happen if you don't that causes you to step out in faith into the midst of that terrifying sea. But through it all, the Lord promises to bring us. And this is the question. Do you believe him? Do you believe God? You see what he does. You see what he promises. You see what he's done in the past. And are you willing to step forward into that which he opens up before you? Because this is his work of deliverance. And yes, it is terrifying. But the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Let's pray.